Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from Here and Now. Thanks for listening. And, you know, sometimes listening brings a smile to your face. Think back to a moment this past year when this show brought you some joy. Now, how about sharing that feeling? Donate to your station to pay it forward. It'll make you feel good. It will make others feel good, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give. Then tell us why you're spreading good vibes this season with hashtag WhyPublicRadio. There has been another attack in Afghanistan. This one killed more than 40 people and injured dozens more. The target was a Shiite cultural center in Kabul, the capital, and ISIS has claimed responsibility. Joining us from Kabul is BBC Persian editor Zia Shahryar. Zia, tell us more about what happened.
Jeremy, the attack has happened early morning around 10 o'clock Kabul time today. It targeted a conference in a cultural center in the west of Kabul, a Shiite cultural center, and they were discussing students from different universities and cultural activists were they gathered in a hall, and apparently the suicide bomber had also managed to enter in the seminar and to act as if he was one of the participants of the seminar. And according to eyewitnesses, a few minutes after the seminar started, the suicide bomber blew up himself among this hall packed with students, female and male students. And I was there and I saw I went after the explosion and I saw the hall and the building was completely destroyed, and it was absolutely a scene of carnage. So hospitals were absolutely alarmed by the number of injured and dead bodies brought to these hospitals in the west of Kabul. And it was absolutely a scene of carnage.
Do we know why this cultural center was targeted?
ISIS has increased attacks on Shia targets, particularly in the west of Kabul, where the majority of the capital's Shia population live. And this is an organization which includes a media branch as well. They have also centers in Mashhad and Tehran of Iran. They have good relationship with cultural and religious organizations in Iran. So it is believed that because they were Shia and because they have connections to Iran, that's possibly the reason why they were targeted.
Is the ISIS claim of responsibility credible? You mentioned that this is something that they would want to attack, but they haven't had the same presence in Afghanistan that they have in some of the other countries in the region.
Many different sources have reported that ISIS has taken responsibility for this attack, like many other attacks that are happening in Kabul and other parts of this country. But there are a lot of doubts and suspicions that is it really, really ISIS connected to ISIS in Syria and Iraq? The government say that these are local groups who have pledged allegiance to ISIS, and many other analysts confirm this. So, but also you have the Shia community blaming circles inside the Afghan government, saying that they might be involved, supported by some foreign groups, which is completely a claim, and so we can't say anything about it. But the Shia community is very, very angry. They believe that the government has failed to protect them, and they're asking for protection.
Well, is there more that the Afghan government could be doing, given its resources, to prevent attacks like this?
The Afghan government is engaged in fighting the Taliban, a very deadly fight. Hundreds of or thousands of Afghan security forces die every day fighting the Taliban, and Daesh has increased its also ground battles in eastern Afghanistan as well as some parts in the northern Afghanistan. So the government's resources are really stretched, and during one of the Shia religious ceremonies, Ashura, which happened 2-3 months ago, the government armed some Shia young men to protect their mosques and their religious places. So that was something that they thought to do. And but the Shia community is asking that the government has to pay more attention to this one. They have to follow up who is involved. They have to find out the routes that ISIS is coming to Afghanistan through, which obviously we haven't seen any sort of official investigation with results on these things.
How are people in Afghanistan feeling about this continued violence? As we've talked about on this program before, this war is now the longest war in U.S. history, but it must be difficult to live through these huge attacks regularly, even so many years after the start of the conflict.
Afghans are absolutely tired of this, and I mean, many citizens express their dissatisfaction with the situation, and they are growing increasingly dissatisfied with the presence of the international troops, particularly the U.S. troops in Afghanistan, because they believe that they could not bring peace and security as they Americans promised. There were some hopes, still some hopes, with the new U.S. strategy to sort of pressure the insurgent groups, the Taliban and the ISIS, to create a more secure atmosphere for Afghans. But there are a lot of suspicions and disbelief that the international troops' presence will not eventually bring security, and people are increasingly becoming suspicious of the international troops' presence in Afghanistan.
That's Zia Shahryar joining us from Kabul, Afghanistan, the site of another attack today, more than 40 people killed. Zia, thank you.
Thank you so much, Jeremy.
Veterinarians, like human doctors, are at high risk of depression and suicide. They carry the weight of their patients' problems and make critical medical choices every day. Mariana Dale of KJZZ reports the animal care community is working to bring awareness about mental health into clinics and classrooms.
Dr. Rebecca Johnson's patients come to her from all walks of life.
How's she been doing at home?
Hi.
Oh, really good.
Hello, you look like you're doing really well.
Today, Chessie the kitten weighs in at just over 4 pounds and is waiting for her latest round of vaccines.
Be brave.
I know.
The Phoenix Area Animal Hospital, where she works, treats cats, dogs, and more exotic animals.
I just did a nail trim on a sugar glider this morning, which is like a little fuzzy squirrel, if you're not familiar with them.
Johnson has been a vet for a decade now. She says it's a profession for helpers.
I really enjoy being able to help people work through the problems that they're experiencing with really important members of their family.
Most vets spend at least 8 years in school. Dr. Johnson graduated with enthusiasm for her new job.
That was a lot of times in the very beginning of my career, balanced by the anxiety at night when I would go home and I would replay all of the patients that I had seen that day and wonder, did I do everything I was supposed to do? What if I made the wrong decision?
A vet might put an animal down and then see a healthy pet like Chessie in their next appointment. It's emotional whiplash. On top of that, veterinarians often carry a lot of student debt. And unlike public hospitals for people, animal clinics can be forced to turn away clients if they can't pay for services.
It just takes a lot of practice to reassure yourself that you've done the best that you could with the information that you had at the time.
Over the years, Johnson has seen firsthand how serious the consequences of stress can be. One of her favorite professors died by suicide. So did a surgeon who worked closely with her clinic.
I don't know what the answer is. I don't know how to fix it, but I know that we need to talk about it more.
A study of U.S. veterinarians found they're almost twice as likely as the general population to experience psychological distress like depression and mental illness. It suggests 1 in 6 have thought about suicide since graduating.
Being kind of obsessed with the troubles of other people, that piles up.
Dr. Charles Figley is a psychologist who's pioneered the study of what's called compassion fatigue. It's a secondary trauma that impacts people who are constantly helping those in pain. Doctors, for example, are at risk for this emotional exhaustion, which could in turn contribute to depression.
They have no way to get around looking into the eyes of their clients to try to figure out how to help them.
Figley compares it to secondhand smoke. You inhale troubles that aren't your own. Symptoms can include anxiety, trouble sleeping, and burnout. Bigley says to combat compassion fatigue with self-care and support.
If they can transform that into lessons and learning from their struggles, then they can transform it into stepping stones.
Before any transformation can happen, people have to recognize there's a problem. Dr. Carla Gartrell is an administrator at Midwestern University, Arizona's only veterinary school.
A lot of our students are high achievers. They haven't dealt with failure before.
She says when she was in vet school 30 years ago, there were no classes outside of science. Today, lessons on communication, mental fatigue, and suicide are baked into the curriculum from year one.
You are going to have to deal with these heavy issues, and you are going to have to carry the weight of, you know, your owner's emotions and help them through it.
Dr. Kelsey Bradley is one of the younger vets at the animal hospital. She noticed her anxiety mounting 6 months out of vet school.
A lot of what we do in the hospital, there's not a lot of time to process it.
Her solution was a monthly meetup for vets and technicians. Over food and drinks, they discussed the hardest cases and the euthanasias.
I thought that we could try to make a place outside of work a place where everyone does understand.
Every meeting ends with a discussion of the best things that happened in the last month. It's a reminder that in addition to healing animals, they can help each other. For Here and Now, I'm Mariana Dale.
All right, to the Hall of Mammals.
To the Hall of Mammals.
To the Hall of Mammals.
Biff, bam, pow, science! Well, like a pair of nerdy wannabe superheroes that we are, Professor Jonathan Losos and I dash into Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology.
We just walk right over here, down the hallway.
Okay, so we actually walked, as you just heard. But Losos is the curator of herpetology here, and he studies lizards and evolution. And he's put a lot of his thinking into the new book, Improbable Destinies, Fate, Chance, and the Future of Evolution. It's an exploration of the strange and wonderful paths that evolution has taken across the planet. Wait, paths, you say? Don't you mean just one path? Because, you know, Darwin figured out survival of the fittest, species are naturally selected, yada, yada, yada. But Professor Losos says there's a whole lot in that yada, yada, yada. In fact, there are still fundamental questions about the way life evolves, such as, are the species we see today inevitabilities? Or are they just evolutionary flukes? And how about this one? If life got another chance to evolve in a similar environment, would the exact same things happen or not?
I think it all started with a scientist here at Harvard, very famous, named Stephen Jay Gould. And he coined this phrase that if you could replay the tape of life, somehow go back and start over, would you get the same outcome? And he argued, no, you would get a very different outcome. Just random, fluky events would send evolution down another path. And the outcome, as a result, would be very different. And so his argument, which was extremely influential, was that there's a role for what he called contingency, just the particular events that happen that shape the course of evolution. And so he at one point said, you know, you could replay the tape a million times and you would never get anything like humans again. But there were actually no data. This was in the 1980s. No one was studying this question. So it was all rhetoric and logic and philosophy, really. But he was so inspirational that people went out and started trying to ask the question of how predictable or repeatable is evolution. And now, 30 years later, we actually do have a lot of data. And those data give us a more nuanced view.
But what are the data, though, right? Because
we
only have our one evolutionary path.
That's exactly right. There's only one history.
Yeah.
But the data are two things. One is, as we have gotten a better and better understanding of the evolutionary tree of life, how species are related to each other, we are discovering many instances in which species that we thought were closely related because they are very similar actually aren't. The debate used to be which one is more common, and we now know both are common. And the real question is trying to understand why you get convergence in some cases and not others.
Can we see some examples of the convergence?
Yes.
Ones?
Well, let's turn around.
Okay.
And here we're looking at an animal called the thylacine, sometimes called the Tasmanian wolf or the Tasmanian tiger. And I think most people, if they saw that and didn't know anything better, would think it's an interesting breed of dog. But it's not. It's a marsupial. It's related to kangaroos, but it adapted to have a very similar lifestyle to wolves, and it has a very similar appearance. And then if we go to the next case over, we have what's called a sugar glider. It's, again, another marsupial, but it looks just like a flying squirrel.
Yeah.
It's got the big flaps of skin, and it can glide from one tree to another. And it's, again, done the exact same thing as the flying squirrel, but it is a marsupial. So marsupials, many of them have evolved convergently with their parallel forms in the rest of the world that are not marsupials.
We still have the duckbill platypus type one-offs, though,
well,
right?
Well, that's, you know, that's what it comes down to, is the debate has come down to the convergent evolution crowd having this long, enormous list of examples of convergent evolution, but the other side could make just as long a list of things that haven't converged.
What does... I always have to take it out to outer space. What does this mean for... If there were an Earth-like planet out there,
well, this is
would we end up with humanoids?
Well, Hollywood thinks so. And there are some people, based on this idea of convergent evolution, on the idea that the environment poses particular challenges and that natural selection finds the same answers, that argue that life on other planets will look very similar to life here, so much so that some people claim that humanoid-type individuals with species with higher intelligence will occur on those planets. I'm dubious. The extent to which convergence occurs, the more distantly related species are, the less likely they are to evolve in the same way, to adapt in the same way. And, of course, you couldn't be more distantly related than a independent life form on another planet. It's much more likely that completely different ways of adapting would evolve.
Right. And we also can't tell sort of what the dominant pressures in the environment were. There's got to be a whole mix of them at any particular time.
Exactly. And in fact, one of the things that biologists are very clear about these days is that a lot of the natural selection pressures come from other species.
Yeah. I mean, well, changing it because of the pressure of different species, it makes me think of the pressures that humankind is putting on the planet and what effect that has on how life is evolving.
That's absolutely true. And that's, you know, the other thing I talk about in my book is that one of the things that Darwin got wrong, and someone just told me, no, you can't say Darwin got something wrong, but the fact is, he thought that evolution occurs extremely slowly. Well, we now know that's wrong. We know that when natural selection pressures are strong, populations can adapt extremely quickly, quickly enough to see over a couple of years' time. And so that means that what we're doing to this planet now, changing the world in so many ways, well, it's an inadvertent evolution experiment. We are subjecting species to new conditions, and we will see if they can adapt to them, and if so, how.
Very sobering.
Well, it's, you know,
I mean, it's happening, but it's also very sobering.
It is sobering, but also exciting in a way. Evolution turns out to be very relevant to the here and now, that understanding how it occurs will tell us how and whether species can adapt.
This is so great. We could spend the whole day in here,
yeah,
but
no
I feel
doubt.
Like we should talk about lizards.
All right. We're going to go back this way. So now we're going to descend into the bowels of the Museum of Comparative Zoology.
Wow. Wow.
Okay, so this room is full of specimens of lizards. It's one of the greatest collections of lizard specimens in the world.
I mean, are we looking at thousands and thousands of specimen jars here?
Yes, we are. This is just like a library with one of these rolling shelves, so it's very economical in squeezing them all in. But as you'll see, there are just jar after jar documenting the diversity of lizards of the world.
Wow. So how did you fall in love with lizards?
Well, I mean, like many children, it started with dinosaurs. I was fascinated with dinosaurs as a little boy. And, you know, this was back in the 1960s where, you know, I read books, I had the plastic animals, I loved dinosaurs. And then as I got older, of course, dinosaurs aren't around, except for birds, we now know, but that didn't really count. So I became fascinated with living reptiles. And a particularly important event in my life when I was about 10 or 11 was convincing my mother to let me get a baby caiman, which is a South American relative of the alligator. And I got them as pets, and they were nasty little animals, but fascinating.
Wow. I mean, I feel like we've talked to so many scientists now that this is a unifying thing, that in their background there was always someone who either couldn't say no or said, try it. That's a great idea.
Absolutely.
And they were going. Then we were headed down the road to more science.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, I guess a part of me wants to know what you think is the craziest lizard species you've got here.
That is a fighting word. Which one? The craziest lizard species. Well, we do have some big guys, but should we look in the tank?
Yes,
do you want to see?
All right. I'd love
to. Okay, we're taking off the lid.
Whoa!
And here we go. A bunch of Nile monitors. They're found throughout the continent. This is a species that has a very long whip-like tail. They can get 5 feet, maybe 6 feet long.
These ones are all balled up. Yeah.
They're all balled up. So let's take a look at one of them. So it's a pretty, if we stretch this guy out, I bet he would be 5 feet long. These are fabulous lizards. These are certainly among the best ones.
What is it that lizards, I mean, this is a very broad question, but what is it that lizards have to teach us?
Well, number one, they're great survivors. They were around at the time of the dinosaurs, and increasingly we're finding very cool fossils of lizards going way back in time. And they're incredibly diverse. Right now, there are about 10,000 species of lizards in the world today, occupying almost any habitat you can imagine on land. They don't get to the far north and far south because it's too cold, but otherwise they're all over the place. And in some areas, you'll find more lizards than you find mammals or birds.
Okay, so the last question I have. Do we know why T-Rex had such short arms?
Do we? That is a great question. The T-Rex had these...
My seven-year-old is dying to know.
These ridiculously little arms for its body size. And, I mean, this highlights both the excitement of evolutionary biology and the frustration. Because, of course, T-Rex has been gone for 66 million years. There's nothing like it today. How do we figure out what its arms are for? And there are lots of ideas. And some of these ideas are kind of crazy. One idea is that it evolved particularly short arms to make sure it didn't bite them off in a feeding frenzy. If only we could do an experiment, get a bunch of theropod dinosaurs, put them on little continents, and come back a million years later and see what happens.
Maybe. There was a movie like that. It didn't turn out well.
Yeah, maybe someday.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. This has been absolutely a joy and fascinating, and I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Well, my pleasure.
Movies and a book, I should have said. Jonathan Losos is curator of herpetology at Harvard's Museum of Comparative Zoology. His new book is Improbable Destinies, Fate, Chance, and the Future of Evolution.
With just a few days to go in 2017, many Americans are rushing to prepay their 2018 property taxes before the new tax law goes into effect. The tax legislation signed by President Trump last week limits deductions for state and local taxes, but the IRS said those prepayments can only be deducted in limited circumstances. Joining us now is Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Hi, Robin.
Jeremy, how are you?
I'm doing well. And who should be doing this? Who should be trying to prepay their property taxes in the next couple of days?
In theory, and I stress in theory at least, it's the highly taxed, wealthier people, especially in areas that are disproportionately exposed, places like Westchester, New Jersey, Northern Virginia, and Maryland, Connecticut. We saw in Fairfax, Virginia, just on Tuesday, it took in $16 million in prepayments just on one day. But there is no guarantee that this stuff is going to go through the system by the time April 15th comes.
Well, and the IRS came out yesterday and said, wait, not so fast. Not everybody can do this. What did they say?
Right. There was an open question and a potential loophole and arbitrage on the prepayment of property taxes. So the IRS swooped in on Wednesday and said you could only avoid the $10,000 cap by paying property taxes assessed in 2017. Now, that sent all sorts of people around the country nervously calling into City Hall and, you know, trying to find their accountants on the phone. They might have been in Aspen or Miami. And it depends on the kind of accountant you have. It depends on how sanguine people in City Hall is. There's a lot left to interpretation here. And we're going to see an interesting experiment between Washington and cities and states and kind of the enforcement. And maybe it's a topic about federalism, ultimately.
I don't know if even the richest accountants can afford Aspen these days, but maybe they can. Now, some states have come out and said that people should be allowed to prepay their 2018 property taxes. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo did that. The Montgomery County, Maryland officials said that they wanted people to be allowed to prepay. Do those kind of things apply when the IRS says not so fast?
you know, it might assuage your anxiety for the time being. I mean, you very rarely see a rush like this of people showing up with checkbooks and wanting to wire money and like, please take my money, please. Because if you're talking about a $10,000 cap or an incremental $10,000, that's $2,500 or $3,000. So the question boils down to the IRS. Will the IRS under Trump crack down on generous interpretations from, you know, cities, states, and CPAs? And I think, you know, April 15th is not that far off. And in the case for a lot of people, it's pay now and just hope into the spring.
It does bring up the bigger issue, which is that this tax law is so new, it is so big, and there seems to be still a lot of confusion about it.
Look, this is the biggest change to tax law in decades, what, maybe 30 years, and it was rapidly passed over a couple of days just a few weeks ago with many last-minute asterisks and trade-offs. So what you're going to see is as people come back from their Christmas dinners and vacations, and this was the topic of conversations, like, do you realize you might lose $4,000 if you don't act, Morty? You know, people racing to scramble and crossing their fingers and hoping that there is generosity in terms of interpretation. But in the meantime, you're going to see significant refund pressure on local governments and continue for more confusion.
Robin Farzad, host of Full Disclosure on NPR One. Robin, thanks and Happy New Year.
Likewise. Thank you, sir.
2018 will be an Olympic year with the Winter Games kicking off in February in South Korea. 2017 was a year in which sports and politics intersected like never before. Here's President Trump at a rally in Alabama in September when he said this about players who were taking a knee during the playing of the national anthem.
Wouldn't you love to see one of these NFL owners, when somebody disrespects our flag, to say, get that son of a off the field right now, out, he's fired. He's fired!
Controversy hit a league that was already dealing with concussions and sexual assault cases against some of its players. Mike Pesca is here now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com, and he joins us now to look back at the year in sports. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
And where do we stand as 2017 ends on this controversy over national anthem protests?
On a precipice, I'd say. Controversy hit the NFL. The NFL has been synonymous with controversy for a while now, and I think mostly because of the concussion issue, which was, let's be blunt about it, covered up or at least so serially ignored as to make it become a dire existential threat to the league. And then out of left field comes this national anthem protest that President Trump, I guess you could say cynically wisely for the sake of politics, tries to use it for himself. There were crosswinds with the NFL. Ratings had gone down last year when Donald Trump was just or the year before when Donald Trump was just descending golden elevators. So he kind of takes advantage. He points to the politics of this moment and this movement. And to some extent, I think he does accelerate the decline of ratings. However, you know, I think the NFL, I know the NFL is still the most popular sport in America. It continues to be. It wouldn't surprise me if the Super Bowl again breaks ratings. So there is a lot of sound and fury around this. I don't know if it signifies nothing, but from a political point of view, I think that it's more opportunism taking advantage of a decline in ratings than Trump causing a decline.
There's also a major racial element to all of this. Let's listen here to Miami Dolphins safety Michael Thomas. Responding to the president after a game in September.
Yeah, I took it personally, but at the same time, like I said in my Twitter post, it's bigger than me, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's bigger than me. I got a daughter. She's going to have to live in this world. You know what I'm saying? And,
you can hear the emotion there in his voice. But what about the racial element to this?
Right. So this taking a knee was inspired by Colin Kaepernick, who didn't take a knee, but he sat for the anthem during preseason games. And Colin Kaepernick has not been allowed to play in the NFL.
Right.
And the issues that players, especially the leaders of the movement, want to focus on include disparities in policing. That's a big one. But other elements. And they've eloquently put forward what their demands are. It's not hard to figure out what they are, what they'd like from the league. And the league, I think mostly in an effort to try to quell this dispute, has said, let's give $1 million here. Let's try to help you lobby members of Congress. Let's do some small things to show that we're good partners, but to really, really to take this national anthem issue away. And it came to the fore when Jerry Jones threatened to, the owner of the Cowboys, threatened to not certify Roger Goodell, NFL commissioner's big raise, because he was just sick and tired of this anthem issue taking so much of the oxygen that he feels his Cowboys, or at least the game itself, should occupy. So yeah, you can't ignore the racial issues at all, as much as the NFL would really love for this to go away.
Okay, let's talk about some of the other big sports stories of the year, including this from baseball.
Corey Seager, the batter, and a swing and a ground ball for Altuve out on the outfield grass. On to first, and the Houston Astros have claimed that city's first ever World Series championship.
Dan Schulman there with the call on ESPN Radio as the Astros beat the Dodgers to win the World Series. Mike, a feel-good story, especially because of the terrible damage that Houston suffered in Hurricane Harvey.
Yes, and they rallied, and the Astros were a terrible team for so long, which, by the way, it wasn't a coincidence. They built the greatness of the current Astros squad based on the fact that they got draft picks by being terrible for a long time. But I think it also is embodied in the player whose name you heard, Altuve, who is the AP's Male Sports Men of the Year,
right,
or Male Athlete of the Year, shortest player in Major League Baseball, and just an excellent all-around player, and a player who has power and speed and is a great fielder. So yes, the Astros were a nice break and a tonic for that region hit by that terrible hurricane.
What about the NBA this year? It was another big year for the Golden State Warriors, who beat the Cleveland Cavaliers to win the title. And this rivalry continues between the two star players, LeBron James and Steph Curry.
Yeah, and their Christmas Day game was once again epic. So as much as we've praised the Astros, we've noted that the NFL is experiencing tough times, the NBA is ascendant. The NBA is getting most of everything right. And they're a league that is embracing what it means to be a professional sports enterprise in 2017. They really understand social media. They're not afraid of their players having personality. They're not afraid of their players expressing opinions. Now, there are reasons for this, and maybe you could say the NBA is lucky. The NBA has 12 players per team, not the 51 that the NFL does. You could see all the NBA players. But I think for years, the NBA, and you could even hear it when their commissioner talks about the players, he always says, you know, our partners. And that's how they think about, that's how the owners who run the league think about the players in the league. There's an acknowledgement that they're partners. And you don't hear that with the NFL. It's a much more top-down hierarchical structure. And that's why I think the NBA is encapsulating encapsulating best practices for a sports league. It's compelling. Even if you don't have your own team that's doing well, there are a dozen players you just want to watch on every night. And every once in a while, Rajon Rondo will get 25 assists, right, like he did in a game between the Pelicans and the Nets last night. So it's just a compelling thing to watch.
Well, and there's another big difference, which is that there are a lot of prominent NBA players and team coaches, owners, who have stood up to President Trump in a way that we're not seeing in the NFL.
Yes, and for a league that's, you know, in the 80-something percent black, that makes sense. The ownership is a bit more diverse, if not racially, though there is that element too, a bit more diverse in terms of the background of the owners. So you have some younger people, you have some, you know, savvy tech,
right,
billionaires instead of, like, say, extractive industries or inherited wealth, and that makes a difference too.
There was also scandal this year, as there always is. Here's some audio from June Kim, acting U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York.
The picture painted by the charges brought today is not a pretty one. Coaches at some of the nation's top programs soliciting and accepting cash bribes.
Mike, this was a criminal scandal involving college basketball. Remind us what happened and what did it expose about the game?
It's funny. I'm sure a lot of your listeners heard that and say, wait, this could be any of a number of sports, right? So the NCAA, this was NCAA basketball, and assistant coaches, top assistant coaches, including a former NBA very good player, Chuck Person of Auburn, took bribes to essentially funnel players to agents and to marketers. And you just have this situation where the NCAA is making, over the course of its contract with the TV networks, over $1 billion to sell its enterprise. And the student athletes are getting none of that. They're getting scholarships, I guess you could say. But look what's going to happen on New Year's Day and with the College Bowls. They will be setting ratings records. They will be putting millions of dollars in the pockets of advertisers and networks. And the kids who are actually out there as the product aren't getting anything. So it opens the door for all sorts of chicanery. And here we have criminal chicanery. There are several coaches still under indictment, and those legal cases are proceeding.
Who would you say are the top athletes of the year, both male and female, in the U.S.?
Okay, so Katie Ledecky won the honor from the AP. She's a great swimmer. Normally in non-Olympic years, we don't watch swimming. Next year will be a Winter Olympic year. So I would say, let's say Michaela Schifrin, the great American skier who won World Cups and is setting records. And I think that will be a name on everyone's lips next year. So it'll be the sort of pick this year where next year, when you look back in retrospect, you'll say, oh, yeah, that made sense. She was great in the World Cup of skiing. Now, with male athlete of the year, Altuve is a great pick. You can't go wrong with any number of baseball players. I think you have to pick a basketball player for everything that I've said.
So is it LeBron or is it Steph Curry?
It's LeBron. And okay, it's boring, but why not just give it to him every year that he's the best basketball player on the planet and that the NBA is the best sport in America? That makes sense to me.
Mike Pesca, Here Now sports analyst who hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thank you and Happy New Year.
You too.
In France, there's a debate over the constitutionality of a new anti-terrorism law. Critics there say it could lead to discrimination against the country's Muslim population. But President Emmanuel Macron says the new law will allow France to end a state of emergency imposed after the Bataclan concert hall massacre 2 years ago. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley joins us from Paris with more now. And Eleanor, it's good to talk with you.
Thank you, Magna. Good to talk to you.
Well, first of all, tell us about this new law. What exactly does it do?
Well, you know, this new law is a bit controversial because what it does is it takes some of the emergency powers. Now, France has been in a state of emergency for 2 years, just came out, like power to the police, and it puts them into the permanent law. Like, for example, police can search and seize. They can go into houses. Under the emergency state, they could just go in and do it. Now they just have to get a judge to sign off on it. And civil rights activists say the judges are going to improve that and approve it automatically, and it's not going to stop them from doing that. People will be able to be held longer under terrorism charges, and it'll up surveillance activities. There's going to be passenger lists on planes now, and religious sites will be able to authorities will be able to close religious sites if there's any suspicion of, you know, radical talk. Now, a lot of human rights activists say that this law is too authoritarian. It resembles the state of emergency too much and that doesn't guarantee civil rights. And I spoke with Yasser Luati. He's a lawyer fighting against discrimination and racism for the Justice and Liberties for All Committee. And this is how he feels about the law.
Yes, it has been lifted, but all of its measures have been passed into the common law. And when you add to it the laws allowing for mass surveillance and arbitrary arrests and the prosecution of people based on mere suspicion, we call that a police state. And therefore, France needs to stop lecturing other countries on human rights and civil liberties and look at its own dismantling of all of its founding principles.
So you can hear his alarm there, Eleanor. Are critics also concerned that French authorities may use these new powers to target certain groups? I mean, particularly Muslims.
Well, yes, they are. And Mr. Luati was worried about that because under the state of emergency, Muslims were targeted, you know, inordinately. And people say that's going to continue under this law. You know, there were so many house searches that took place in the middle of the night. And, you know, critics say that children were just, you know, gotten out of bed and just so shocked. And only a small percentage of those searches actually led to anything to do with terrorism. They say under this law, it will be too easy to continue like that. But, you know, I spoke with someone on the other end of the spectrum, another lawyer, and also he heads a think tank that advises the French government on homeland security. His name is Thibaut de Montbrial, and he says this new law has to be tough because things have dramatically changed in France.
How can a democracy defend itself? Our challenge now is that we are being attacked by people who are French. France has a long experience of fighting terrorism, but all the previous waves tough ones happened in the 80s, in the 90s, were waves coming from abroad. And there were waves acted by dozens of people. Today's wave is a wave coming from inside, people who are French. And there are not dozens, there are thousands.
Well, I suppose we should remind people about that change that you mentioned, Eleanor, because, of course, it was in November 2015 that an awful terrorist rampage in France killed more than 100 people. And that was what caused the state of emergency. Now, during that time, Eleanor, I mean, what kind of hardships were imposed, if any, on French people?
Well, actually, polls that have been done showed that French people liked and felt more secure with the state of emergency. You know, it put 10,000 soldiers on French streets. So there were soldiers all around monuments like the Eiffel Tower and at train stations. But, you know, it was really tough on those soldiers and on the police who faced burnout. They never stopped working. And, you know, people even, you know, on both sides, they say you have to come out of a state of emergency. You cannot live permanently in a state of emergency. So even though, you know, terrorist plots were foiled, many people said that the state of emergency was not efficient. And so this law is supposed to replace it in a more efficient manner and just, you know, take everything down a level.
I see. And so President Macron saying that this is what allows France to exit the state of emergency. But does it? So I guess it seems like there's a point of agreement there that no one really thought that the country could stay in that state permanently.
That's the point of agreement. And there has been this long debate over, you know, how much of the law does it protect civil rights? You know, France is a country of, you know, guaranteeing, you know, human rights, civil rights. But you need to protect those, but you also have to protect citizens. And France did, you know, have two massive and very bad terrorist attacks in 2015. So this is sort of just a, you know, a compromise solution. And not everyone is happy with it, but that's what we're having today. And now it's a couple elements and it still need to be reviewed by the French Constitutional Court. And that will be in the coming months.
That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley speaking to us from Paris. Eleanor, thank you so much.
Thank you, Magna.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service.
Music courtesy of APM.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.